Welcome to this program, recorded in Chicago at the Inflation and Gold Seminar, sponsored by U.S. Paper Exchange, Tempor Corporation, May 24th through the 26th, 1980. Our topic is gold, the solution to our monetary dilemma. Our speaker is George Reisman, Associate Professor of Economics at Pepperdine University, Los Angeles. Now to our program.
Is Dr. George Reisman, who is currently Associate Professor of Economics at Pepperdine University in Los Angeles. He received his doctorate from New York University in 1963, where he studied under the late Ludwig von Mises, the leading economic defender of capitalism. Dr. Reisman is the author of articles on economics, which have appeared in a variety of leading publications. He is the translator of von Mises' work, Epistemological Problems of Economics, and is author of The Government Against the Economy. I think attendees of this seminar are fortunate to receive Dr. Reisman's well-reasoned answers to three questions which frequently arise when discussing gold. The first question is, what would be the value of gold in terms of purchasing power in a hyperinflationary economy or if gold was remonetized? The answer to this is in Dr. Reisman's article, Inflation and the Price of Gold, contained in your agenda booklet. The other two questions are, how can the inflationary spiral be stopped, and what would be the effects on the economy upon converting to a gold standard? Answering these questions now, in his talk, Gold, the Solution to Our Monetary Dilemma, is Dr. George Reisman.
Thank you very much. Thank you for coming down this morning to hear my talk, the subject of which, as you all know, is gold, the solution to our monetary dilemma. Can I be heard clearly throughout the room? Okay. The fact that we are faced with a monetary dilemma, I do not think will come as any surprise to you. Some very able writers have been describing it for years. The nature of our dilemma is that our government is faced with a choice between a 1929-style depression and a 1923 German-style currency collapse. The dilemma arises from the fact that it has been pursuing a policy of inflation and credit expansion, that is, of money creation, for several decades without any serious interruption. In this period, the economic system has become geared to the continuation and acceleration of inflation. Like a drug addict, it's gotten hooked on inflation. It needs bigger and bigger doses, and to stop or cut down the dosage now must produce terrible withdrawal symptoms, a depression. I don't think there can be any doubt which way the government will choose. It's not only hooked on inflation, it's got the key to the drug cabinet. It's got an unlimited ability to create money. Thus, it will go on inflating at an accelerating rate. For the same reason, I don't see any possibility of a so-called soft landing, of a gradual deceleration of inflation, because even a modest decline must produce enough pain to send the government running back for the money needle. The ultimate outcome must be a hyperinflationary currency collapse, with paper money being dumped in the streets as just so much litter. I'd like to explain to you how I think this terrible dilemma might, in principle, be eliminated. How, in other words, inflation might be stopped cold without the necessity of a depression. Before I do so, I have to say that I'm not concerned here with the likelihood of the proposal I'm going to make actually being adopted. I'm concerned only with the question of whether, in principle, there is some way out of our dilemma. That is, whether there is some way that if people were willing to adopt it, we could solve our dilemma. If there is such a way, then the question of how to gain support for it can be dealt with separately. I think that it's important to establish that there is a way out in principle for two reasons. First, it makes a vital difference to one's view of the world to know that solutions to our major politico-economic problems are possible, even if, for the present, people don't choose to adopt them. So long as solutions are possible, one has a reason to go on fighting. If solutions were simply impossible, no matter what choices people made, there would be no basis for any attempts to solve our problems. Second, the mere articulation of a solution can aid in achieving values that are related to the proposed solution, but which do not depend on the solution itself actually being implemented. For example, the misguided espousal of socialism as the solution to the world's economic problems helped to achieve many goals of the socialists even before it achieved actual socialism, such as labor legislation, social security, and so on. Please keep these considerations in mind as I propose what must otherwise sound like a strictly utopian solution. So here goes. Simply put, my solution to our monetary dilemma would be the adoption of a 100% reserve gold coin standard at an appropriately high price of gold. Actually, silver coins too would have to play a prominent role alongside of gold, but for the sake of simplicity, I will ignore silver. Under such a gold standard, gold coins would form a substantial portion of the circulating money supply that passes from hand to hand. All paper and checkbook money would be 100% backed by gold coins payable on demand. Such a system, I believe, is not only the ideal monetary system for the long run, because it would permanently eliminate the threat of both inflation and deflation, but is the only system potentially capable of solving the terrible dilemma we are faced with today. In order to explain how the adoption of this system could solve our dilemma, I must explain in some detail why stopping inflation under our present paper money system would cause a depression. The analogy to a drug addict who goes cold turkey, while accurate, is not sufficient. We have to understand the inner nature of the inflation addiction, so to speak, and thus exactly what it is about stopping an inflation that produces a depression. Only then can we understand how the adoption of the 100% reserve gold coin standard could serve as an appropriate remedy. So let me try to briefly explain the inflation depression process under paper money. The most important thing to realize is that inflation undermines the need and desire to own money balances. As a result, it causes a more rapid spending of money, a rise in what economists call the velocity of circulation of money. This occurs in a variety of ways. One way is that as inflation proceeds, people get accustomed to rising prices and come to expect them to go on rising. When that happens, they start buying sooner before prices rise further. Another way that inflation leads to a rise in the velocity of circulation of money is that it raises interest rates. This makes it worthwhile for people to lend out short-term sums of money that would otherwise have remained in cash holdings. A third way is that the prospect of easily obtaining loans manufactured by the banking system through the creation of new money leads businesses to invest their cash reserves, since they expect that when they need money, they can obtain it from their banks. In these ways, inflation of the money supply brings about an even greater inflation of the volume of spending in the economy. Spending rises not only because there is more money, but also because the increase in the quantity of money leads to a more rapid spending of money. Now observe that the other side of spending is people's revenues and incomes, since one man's spending is another man's receipts. Obviously, in superinflating the volume of spending in the economy, inflation also superinflates people's revenues and incomes. Inflation also does something else. It encourages people to pile up a mass of debt that they can pay only so long as their revenues and incomes hold up. Indeed, only so long as their revenues and incomes go on increasing. One way that inflation encourages debt is simply by leading people to borrow in anticipation of rising prices and as a hedge against further inflation. Housing purchases today are a prime example of the influence of inflation. People go heavily into debt to buy houses at already inflated prices because they expect prices to go on rising. The same thing happens with business spending for plant and equipment and inventories. But even before rising prices become taken for granted, inflation encourages borrowing by holding down the rate of interest in relation to the rate of profit. I know that I said inflation raises the rate of interest, and it does. It does so because as new money enters the economy and gets spent, it drives up sales revenues and profits. It thus raises the rate of profit, and that pulls up the rate of interest. But to the extent that inflation takes place in the form of credit expansion, the creation of new loanable funds, the rate of interest, even though rising, lags behind the rise in the rate of profit. As a result, inflation makes borrowing exceptionally profitable, and the more so, the more leverage the borrowing provides. In sum, we've got inflation doing two critical things. It superinflates people's revenues and incomes, and it leads them to pile up heavy debts against those revenues and incomes. This is what sets the stage for a depression if inflation stops, because then the causes of a low need and desire to hold money balances are removed. People then start trying to rebuild their money balances. As a result, spending and the velocity of circulation fall. So people's money revenues and incomes fall. Then they can't pay their debts. Mass bankruptcies occur. In the process, banks fail and the money supply actually gets reduced. This, I believe, is the essence of the inflation depression process. The critical factor is the contraction in spending and revenues following the end of inflation, which leaves people with no means of paying their debts. Now, this contraction in spending and the consequent bankruptcies is what the transition to a 100% reserve gold coin standard could avoid, while representing a complete halt to all further inflation. Let me explain what I mean. To do so, I have to go back again to our present paper money system and look at things the way they stand in concrete dollars and cents terms. Right now, we have a money supply of roughly $400 billion. We also have a gross national product of about $2,500 billion. Gross national product, or GNP for short, can be taken as an indication of total spending in the economy. Actually, it's a lot smaller than total spending, but it can serve as an indication nonetheless. Because GNP is $2,500 billion, while our money supply is $400 billion, the velocity of circulation of money, the kind economists call income velocity, is a little more than 6. It's just GNP divided by the money supply. And of course, it represents the number of times in a year that the average dollar or unit of the money supply is spent in a way that counts in GNP. If we froze the money supply at $400 billion, and especially if the money supply actually started dropping, as it did from 1929 to 1933, velocity might easily fall to 3 or even less. In most of the 30s, it was significantly less than 3. That would be coming down from the present 6. Obviously, to whatever extent velocity fell, even with a money supply of $400 billion, GNP would fall, people's revenues and incomes would fall, and there would be mass bankruptcies. The banks would be under pressure, and if not bailed out by the government, they would fail too, reducing the money supply as they went. But now, to begin to understand how gold could save the situation, imagine that our $400 billion money supply consisted of gold coins. Imagine that to bring this about, the government took its present gold holding of 265 million ounces and priced it high enough to make it equal to $400 billion. A price of about $1,500 per ounce would accomplish this. You just multiply 1,500 times 265 million and you've got roughly $400 billion. Imagine that the government physically distributed this gold to the people, It called in all the paper currency, amounting to about $100 billion, and gave out gold coins in exchange. And it turned the remaining $300 billion of its gold over to the banks to place their checking deposits on a 100% gold reserve basis. For the sake of maximum simplicity, we could think of the money supply as now consisting of 265 million 1-ounce gold coins. Obviously, smaller denominations would be necessary, but let's think of it this way. Imagine that on one side of each of these coins, it said 1 ounce of gold, and on the other side, $1,500. The money supply could then be looked at as being either 265 million gold ounces or $400 billion. People would certainly want to hold this gold money supply very tightly, because the possibility of inflation would now be over for sure, since the money supply would actually be gold, and thus there would physically be just no way for the government to increase it. People would hold the money not as dollars, but as pieces of gold. Let's imagine that people wanted to hold this money supply so tightly that its velocity of circulation would be only 2. The effect would be that in terms of dollars, GNP would fall all the way to $800 billion. In terms of gold, GNP would be just twice the 265 million ounces of gold, or 530 million ounces. You have a dollar money supply of $400 billion, a velocity of 2, that's a dollar GNP of $800 billion, a gold money supply of 265 million, a velocity of 2, that's 530 million gold ounces as a gold GNP. Now let's make a change in our example. While the gold money supply remains at 265 million ounces, and its velocity remains at 2, because it's gold that people are holding, let's see what happens if we plug in a higher price of gold. Imagine that on the dollar side of each of the 1 ounce gold coins that constituted the money supply, it said not $1,500, but $3,000. Observe, the gold money supply remains 265 million ounces. Those are the coins that the people actually have. And the gold GNP remains 530 million ounces. But the dollar money supply now becomes 800 billion, twice as large. And the dollar GNP now becomes 1,600 billion, also twice as large. Let's carry this a step further. At a gold price of 4,500, the 265 million ounce gold money supply becomes equal to a dollar money supply of 1,200 billion. And the 530 million ounce gold GNP becomes equal to a $2,400 billion GNP. Just one more small step, and a gold price of a little more than $4,700 per ounce yields the original present dollar GNP of $2,500 billion. Now, I'm not in fact advocating a gold price nearly as high as $4,700 for reasons that I will explain in a few minutes. I used it just to illustrate an important point. And that is, in principle, it would be possible to stop inflation cold with a 100% gold money and simultaneously offset the fall in the velocity of circulation of money by making the gold supply equal to enough dollars to leave spending in terms of dollars unchanged. In other words, it's possible to stop inflation cold and yet avoid the contraction in dollars spent that would otherwise result from a greater need and desire to hold money, simply by making the gold stock equal to enough dollars. Thus, one major aspect of the depression problem could be solved, the contraction in spending that results when inflation is stopped. What about the other aspect, the excessive debt burden? The transition to a 100% reserve gold coin system would be able to solve that too. If there were no other way to solve it, gold could simply be priced high enough to give people an actual sudden increase in their revenues and incomes calculated in dollars. In such circumstances, the transition to the system would be accompanied by the equivalent of a last burst of inflation. But the transition to the system could avoid mass bankruptcies in another way, which would not entail any further losses to creditors. This concerns the effects of distributing most of the country's gold to the banks to place them on a 100% reserve basis against their checking deposits. As I indicated, at present, it would take about $300 billion in gold to do this. The transfer of this gold to the banking system would represent an enormous increase in its assets, since its present reserve assets are less than $50 billion. To give the banks $300 billion of reserves in place of $50 billion of reserves would increase their assets by $250 billion, which would represent an enormous enrichment to which the banks are clearly not entitled. In the circumstances, the appropriate thing to do would be to pass along the benefit of most of the additional assets to the banks' borrowers by reducing their debts to the banks. For if the banks are getting $250 billion in additional reserve assets, they would still gain substantially, even if their other assets, in the form of borrowers' IOUs and the like, were reduced by $200 billion or more. The reduction in the banking system's other assets, which are the debts of individuals and businesses, would certainly go a long way toward solving the problem of excessive debt without further harm to creditors. I now have to introduce an important complication into the discussion, which is the fact that the United States is only one country in the world economy. If the United States went to gold at $4,700 per ounce, or even $1,500 per ounce, and were the only country to do so, it would probably experience an enormous increase in its gold stock. It might attract half or even much more than half of the world's monetary gold, for until sufficient gold came in, its value would be higher here than anywhere else. Estimates of the world's gold stock vary between 2 and 3 billion ounces. Some may even go higher. Thus, even at a price of $1,500 per ounce, we might end up with a gold stock of well over a billion ounces, and thus a substantial increase in GNP in terms of dollars. Furthermore, the country could be exhausted in producing the exports needed to import all this gold. And even if we could overcome this problem, there could be a further problem. Namely, what if the American economy became geared to the use of such a substantial proportion of the world's gold, and then other countries began going over to gold? At that time, we'd begin experiencing massive gold outflows. We could have a kind of deflation in gold. This leads to the conclusion that any kind of reasonably smooth transition to a 100% reserve gold coin system would have to be accomplished internationally. It would have to be undertaken simultaneously by as many of the world's economically important countries as possible. It would need the cooperation of the common market countries, Japan, the Middle Eastern countries, and the larger Latin American countries, and the former British dominions, as well as the United States. If this were done, then it would probably be possible for the United States to adopt the system at a gold price of no more than about $2,500 per ounce in terms of today's buying power. I arrive at this figure on the conservative assumption of a world gold stock of 2 billion ounces and the further assumption that the American economy represents about one-fourth of the world's economy. As a result, I estimate our potential gold money supply under a worldwide 100% reserve system as 500 million ounces. Assuming a velocity of 2, our gold gross national product would be 1 billion ounces. Given today's dollar GNP of $2,500 billion, gold would have to be priced at $2,500 per ounce to make it possible for the billion ounce gold GNP to represent an unchanged dollar GNP and thus avoid a contraction in dollar revenues and incomes. Next year, of course, the appropriate gold price would be higher. The principle is simply to price gold in such a way that the prospective gold ounce GNP of the country is made to equal the country's GNP in dollars at the time the transition is to be made. Of course, even if the system were adopted internationally, a great deal would depend on the accuracy of the estimates of the world's gold stock, the relative share of it that an individual country could expect to attract, and the prospective velocity of gold money in that country. These would obviously be crucial to determining the appropriate price of gold for that country. Major errors would certainly be possible. I, for one, would favor erring on the side of too high a price of gold rather than too low. This at least would avoid mass bankruptcies, which, given the inability of our judiciary to keep pace even with its current caseload, would probably take a decade or more to get sorted out, which would mean that in the interval, the economy would be largely paralyzed because no one would know just who owned what. So I think it's vital to avoid mass bankruptcies. But no matter what errors might be made in picking the right price of gold, the adoption of the 100% reserve gold coin system would have to represent an enormous improvement over our present paper money system. And this is true even in the event of our having to adopt the system unilaterally. For suppose too high a price of gold were selected, that would be equivalent to a burst of additional inflation from the perspective of dollars. But whatever the size of this burst, the paper money system will soon produce much more inflation, for it continues to inflate and does so at an accelerating pace, while the burst would be non-repeatable on the gold system. Suppose the price of gold were set too low and a depression did begin to develop. The debt-paying power of the gold in terms of dollars could then be raised. But the most important thing would be that the government would not be able to inflate the physical gold stock, which by then would be the actual money of the country. Thus, it would not be able to go on with the destruction of money and of the whole division of labor system, which depends on money. Finally, even if we adopted the system unilaterally and did import a vast quantity of gold in exchange for our goods, our losses as individuals would be no greater, in fact, they would be a lot less, than under the present paper money system. Under the paper money system, every year, each of us, in effect, imports paper money in exchange for his goods or services. For each of us almost always finishes the year with a larger holding of paper money, including checking balances, than he began it, and we have had to trade away our goods and services to do so. But unlike gold, with paper money, there is no end to the process, short of the destruction of the paper money in a currency collapse. If we had to import excess gold, not only would there be an end in sight, but we could probably count on later on exporting the gold at a higher value so that our loss on that count would not be permanent. In fact, if we used most of the excess gold coming in from a unilateral adoption of the system to build up our cash holdings and did not gear the operation of the economy to it, we might actually profit in the long run by being the first country to adopt gold. For we would acquire gold at a relatively low value when only we wanted it, and then give it back to the rest of the world at a much higher value when everyone else wanted it as well. It's time to summarize. The essence of my idea is simply this. We can stop inflation cold by switching to a 100% reserve gold coin system, which the government lacks the physical power to inflate. And to stop this from producing a depression, we call the country's gold money supply the equivalent of enough dollars so that no matter how tightly it is held, there is no contraction of spending calculated in dollars. Thus, the critical factor in producing a depression is removed. At the same time, the upward revaluation of gold and the massive transfer of gold assets to the banking system makes possible a large-scale cancellation of bank debt, thereby substantially reducing the overall debt burden in the economy and avoiding the mass bankruptcies characteristic of a depression. As a final note, it cannot be stressed too strongly how vital is the 100% reserve coin element if gold is to be used to solve our dilemma. If the attempt were made to go to gold without this element, that is, with the government continuing to hold the gold and the people using paper, the effect of a sharply higher price of gold would merely be more inflation and an actual increase in the velocity of circulation of money. For then, people would experience merely an increase in the quantity of paper dollars that could be endlessly repeated. On the 100% reserve gold coin system, what they are holding is not dollars, but gold. The velocity of money is then determined by the fact that the pieces of money are gold. The pieces of gold are held tightly, and the number of dollars the pieces are called is then unable to affect the rate at which the money is spent. Now, since I've already acknowledged that my proposal may sound utopian, I'm willing to go further and indicate its connection with an even wider program of reform. I believe that if we could solve our monetary dilemma in the way I have explained, by ending inflation in an environment of great financial liquidity, that is, of large holdings of gold money relative to spending, we could also radically reduce the size of the government's budget and the scope of government activity without fear of causing mass unemployment or a depression. It's widely believed, and I think at least one speaker here expressed the thought, that if we seriously cut back government spending, we'd cause an enormous problem of adjustment and probably a depression, and thus we just couldn't do it. All of this is probably true under present monetary conditions, where the debt structure stands like a house of cards, and the least failure of demand anywhere in the economic system is capable of producing a wave of bankruptcies. But it would not be true if our economy possessed the high degree of liquidity that a 100% reserve gold coin system could give it. If firms possessed large cash reserves and smaller debts relative to their revenues and incomes, they would be able to ride out the kind of temporary, localized failures of demand that would accompany slashing the government's budget. They would be in a position of financial strength comparable to what they enjoyed in 1946. It's been forgotten, but between 1945 and 1946, a period of just 1 year, federal government spending in the United States was reduced by about 60%, from $85 billion to $35 billion, and more than 10 million government employees were dismissed. This was the conversion from the war economy to a peacetime economy. At the time, many people feared that the result would be mass unemployment and a resumption of the Depression. The actual effect was not unemployment, but a rapid and radical change in the type of employment. The millions of former soldiers and sailors and war workers quickly changed jobs and began producing goods and services of value to the lives and well-being of individuals. The net effect was simply an enormous rise in the standard of living. All this was possible because the tremendous financial strength of the economy, indicated by a velocity of circulation of money of less than 2 in 1946, guaranteed that as government spending fell, private spending would increase correspondingly, for there was simply no need to build up liquidity any higher than it already was. If we could achieve comparable financial strength today, as I believe we could with a 100% reserve gold coin standard, then I am convinced our economy could experience a far more dramatic improvement than it did in 1946. In 1946, our improvement came from the fact that we were able to disband an American army that had fought on foreign soil in the defense of the United States. Today, our improvement would come from disbanding a virtual enemy army that operates on our own shores against the American people. I'm talking of the massive government bureaucracy that redistributes and consumes the American people's wealth while doing its utmost to stop them from producing it. Disband this enemy army, and our output of goods and services must skyrocket. Thus, as I see it, the 100% reserve gold coin standard is a critical element in the economic reconstruction of the United States. It could stop inflation without depression and set the stage for the rapid and radical reduction of government activity. What I have said here this morning, ladies and gentlemen, represents my own best thinking thus far about how we might get ourselves out of the terrible mess we are in. I know that the solution I have suggested for our monetary dilemma could certainly be accompanied by some serious problems for a while, especially if we had to adopt it unilaterally. I hope that as a result of my talk, you too will be stimulated to think about solutions. So I invite your comments, your criticisms, and your own proposals, as well as your questions, not just in the next few minutes, but in the future as well. I know I may stand a good chance of learning from them. Thank you.
Dr. Reisman will take questions, and if anyone would like to write them out, someone will hold them up, send them out to the aisle, and someone will pick them up.
What is the response of the academic
What is the response of the academic community to plans like this? I really don't know. This is the first time I've proposed it. I've discussed it in my classes somewhat, but I've had no chance for a reaction. Yes, sir?
Could you give a little bit more detail on what you mean by
All right. Well, the basic point is the banks presently have about $50 billion in reserve assets. That's currency in the till and deposits with the Federal Reserve System. Now, if the banks received $300 billion in place of the $50 billion, that's a huge bulge in their assets. The precise method of how would you reduce debts, you would probably have to prorate it. You could perhaps total up what is the total indebtedness to a given bank at any given time. And if a given bank were receiving, let's imagine, $1 billion extra dollars, and the total debts of its customers to it were $5 billion, then perhaps each of them might have a 20% reduction in his debt. Obviously, you'd have problems arising. How would you handle securities that the banks possessed as opposed to loans? And I know the details of this would need to be worked out. Yes?
Sounds like a little bit of something for nothing. People got themselves in line for giving gifts or people never got themselves.
Well, there's validity to that. And I am uncomfortable, frankly, with the government having to do this, but the problems are such that I don't think there is a smooth way out, and the government got most of the gold that it has by forcing the banks to turn the gold over to them in World War I. So I grant you there's a problem. And it's not the kind of system that we would want permanently, but I think the point is you want to get the government out of money. You want to avoid a massive depression in the process. And as far as I could see, this seems like a possible way of doing it. Mr. Blyberg?
Yes, sir. I'm a little concerned about that particular aspect. Going from the theoretical to the practical.
Yeah.
Let's say that your ideas began to take hold. Aren't you thereby creating a huge incentive for everybody to rush to the bank and take out a loan? In order to share the pitfall, as the other gentleman quite properly points out, which is a major aspect of your plan that bothers me.
Okay, that's certainly a very good criticism. That perhaps could happen. If people thought this were to be adopted, they could try to rush to the banks to borrow. But I don't think the problem, that problem would be nearly as great as the bulge in borrowing that we can expect to materialize and already has materialized with the paper money system. Now today, people can borrow in the expectation that they don't have to repay anything, because you are going to repay paper money, which is headed for valuelessness. Now, under this arrangement, you perhaps might borrow and a portion of the debt might be canceled, but I don't think that begins to approach the problem that we have with paper money. And perhaps it might be, you could say, that it applies to debts incurred prior to a certain cutoff date. I mean, there is another way. You see, you could reduce the problem of debts very easily if you had a high enough price of gold. You could make gold equal to so many dollars that anyone who sold anything for the smallest gold coin, if that were called enough dollars, he'd easily pay off his debts. But that, I think, would be a method that would impoverish creditors even more. See, the problem is we are in a situation where there is really no perfect way out. And I think if you could, if it's possible to avoid a massive depression, that would be a major endorsement of a system. The gentleman in the far back. What would happen under my proposal to the vast number of people on welfare and getting government handouts? Okay. Well, if you have a system where as the government stops spending money and we know that private individuals would be in a greater position to start spending more of it, what you would have to do, you'd have to go even a little further now, you would have to, on the one hand, start radically reducing the whole welfare system. You could have, you'd have to do two things. You'd have to abolish the obstacles in the way of people getting jobs, like the minimum wage legislation and the power of the labor unions to enforce minimum wage scales for skilled workers. And then you could change the standard on welfare. You could say that if someone is genuinely crippled and disabled and incapable of work, you could continue some allowance for them. But anyone who is able-bodied would simply have to go to work. Mr. Schiff? No, a gold price of $2,500 would be accompanied by an increase in the real value of gold. You see, what I'm saying is that to the extent that gold is used as money, or even now, just look at what's happened in the last 10 years, the price of gold has risen, but it's risen a lot further than the prices of practically everything else. So its real buying power increases. Now, if we have only a limited amount of gold, and if gold is to serve as money, and people want to hold that money very, very tightly, the buying power of gold actually must increase. Yes, if we had a higher real value of gold, it's also true, and that's a very good observation, that there would be some increase in the mining of gold. And that could occur, and perhaps that could be somewhat significant. But the most important point to realize is that in order to mine additional gold, you have to go out and dig it. And the costs of extracting additional gold in any significant quantities are extremely high. Now, you see, if gold were used as money, the demand for gold would be vastly greater. The value of something depends not just on the supply of it, but also the demand. To the extent that you increase the monetary role of gold, or to the extent that people just want to own more of it and hold it, its real value rises relative to other goods. And so what I'm saying is, even if, you see, suppose we went to gold at $1,500 an ounce. $1,500 would make the present gold stock equal to the present paper money supply. Now, just imagine we did that. If there is to be no further increase in the supply of money, the existing money would be held very, very tightly. People would want to own that money. Well, what must happen to its value? Announcements of a few months ago did. Suppose we got into a simple depression. What would happen to the value of money? It would go up. Well, what I'm saying is, if we converted to 100% gold reserve system, the gold would achieve the kind of buying power. We would have a money supply with a buying power such that it usually takes a depression to produce. Only we could get it without the depression. Dr. Hessen?
value, say, at $4,800 an ounce, and traditional relationship between gold and silver is 15 to 1, an ounce of silver would be worth $300. What would be the actual circulating medium in which it would be in the newspapers? In other words, what money could be the fractional bid?
Okay. All right, but now, you see, if gold were valued at $4,800 an ounce, then you would have prices of goods and services rising in dollars as well. So if you ask what would be the circulating medium for smaller denominations, I don't think that would be the problem, because what we presently pay 25 cents or 50 cents for a newspaper in those circumstances would be costing you $1 or $2. But to do it in terms of real value, if an ounce of gold had a buying power, let's assume, of $2,500, and an ounce of silver at 15 to 1 had a buying power of 1/15 that, let's say it would be $150 or whatever, well then the smallest practical size silver coin, like a dime, might have a buying power on the order of 10 present dollars. Now that is a problem. I touch on that in the article I have in the agenda. But now this would mean if a silver dime or the smallest practical silver coin had a buying power on the order of $10 of our present dollars, that would mean a penny would have a buying power on the order of a present dollar. And in that environment, you would need half-cent pieces. And this is the way conditions actually were in the 19th century. If you look back at old restaurant menus, let's say, from the middle of the 19th century, you may have been surprised to read you could get a full meal for a dime. Well, what enabled a full meal to be bought for a dime was a huge purchasing power of the precious metals. And that's the kind of purchasing power that we'd be talking about. In that kind of environment, the smallest monetary units have substantial buying power. Instead of our present system, where we could easily dispense with pennies, nickels, and dimes, and no one would notice it, on a hard money system, you would need coins of perhaps half-cent denomination and even a little less. You'd be buying things in bigger units, like instead of pouring change into a vending machine to get just a little bit, you'd pour a couple of cents in and you'd get a huge quantity out. Now, the reason, you see, the reason the precious metals had vastly greater buying power back in the 19th century than they do now or have had until very recently is because the demand for precious metals was much greater then than now, because precious metals played a much greater role in the monetary system. And what made it possible for the precious metals to lose their buying power was the demand for them for monetary purposes was steadily reduced, and so you could have the prices of other things continuously rising while their prices stayed the same. I agree with all that you say, but the economists, in quotes, in Washington strongly disagree. They favor a revaluation with issuing a new paper money, which they could begin to inflate all over again. What are the effects of such a program? Well, would I be correct in interpreting the question to mean that they would have a gold standard, but we would actually use paper money, or they simply want to continue as they are now? Just continue as they are now.
Right. Turn up a new form of money and say, you bring in your $5 and you give you $1, $2 exchange.
Well, you see, the kind of reform where you bring in $5 and they give you one new dollar, that really has no major economic effects. It's equivalent to moving the decimal point. If we just simply state everything as 1/5 or 1/10, we're not changing anything. And that's simply to avoid the embarrassment of having to use hundreds of the monetary units to buy a stick of gum. I don't think that that would be of any significance. Mr. Crawford? Okay, well, I believe, you see, I think that the actual way that we are going to get to gold, if we do get there, would not be by this sort of proposal being adopted. I really don't expect that tomorrow morning the Treasury is going to want to consider it. If the government does not prevent people from acquiring the precious metals, if it just goes on with its policy of inflation, the market is going to remonetize the precious metals. And the way it will happen is more and more people, just like yourselves, will be acquiring gold and silver coins. And once you reach some critical mass of the population owning gold and silver, then you're going to find people who have gold and silver who want to buy something. They will start meeting sellers who'd like to acquire gold and silver. And then gold and silver can start exchanging directly against goods. And once people see that some portion of the population is willing to sell goods for gold and silver because they want to save the gold and silver, then even people who themselves don't wish to save gold and silver will be willing to take it in trade because they know they can buy things from people who do want to save the gold and silver. And then you have the marketability of gold and silver being widened, and then more people will take it. And this is how gold and silver got to be money in the first place. Now, I think all you need to reestablish gold and silver as money, all you need to radically increase the real value of gold and silver, is if the government just goes on as it's doing, creating paper, and doesn't place insuperable obstacles in the way of people owning gold. The rise in the real value of gold is due to the fact that more and more people want to save it as an inflation hedge, which is based on the fact that the government keeps inflating. And as this widens, gold, the widespread gold ownership as a store of value will create its use as a medium of exchange. Please address the problem of current outstanding national debt and the creditors that hold bonds. Well, the current problem, the national debt is headed for worthlessness. Anyone who buys a government bond is buying virtually nothing. Did you mean the problem in terms of going to 100% reserve gold system? Okay. All right. Well, if you, to the extent that you went to 100% reserve system at a price of gold greater than $1,500 an ounce, you see, $1,500 an ounce at present makes the government's gold stock equal to the present money supply. Now, if you go to gold above $1,500 an ounce, then the government doesn't need its full gold stock to equal the money supply, the present money supply. There would be gold left over that the government did not have to use either to redeem currency or give to the banks. That gold could be used to reduce a portion of the national debt. Yes, sir?
How would the implementation of your plan affect the present Federal Reserve System?
How would it affect the present Federal Reserve System? In the process, the Federal Reserve System would be abolished. Yes, sir? Absolutely, it's a 100% reserve system. Now, it's an important point has to be stressed. The issue of 100% reserve and fractional reserve pertains only to demand deposits subject to check. It does not apply to time deposits or savings deposits. If someone makes a savings deposit, he parts with his ability to spend the money until such time as he makes a withdrawal. He's granting genuine credit. There is no basis for requiring 100% reserve against time or savings deposits. It's simply, when you have checking deposits or banknotes, you have when you make a checking deposit or acquire banknotes, you are not parting with your ability to spend money. You are not granting credit in any way. You're simply changing the form of your money. That's where 100% reserve is required. Yes? What would you do with the Social Security debt? All right. I think that what would have to be done realistically is you'd have to divide people who are in the Social Security age brackets into two basic categories: those who are genuinely helpless, who could get some help from the government, versus those who are capable of working. And the Social Security benefits would have to be, for those capable of working, sharply scaled down, and the program would have to be phased out altogether.
Okay. Thank you very much, Dr. Reeson.
Thank you. That concludes this program from the Inflation and Gold Seminar.